Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Your Own Personal Beatles, the final sort of regular weekly episode of this run. But my name's Jack Pelling, and with me, as always...
It's me, Robin Allender. Hello.
How you doing?
Really good. Yeah, not bad. We've got a fun episode coming up with Pictish Trail, aka Johnny Lynch, which was a really good chat, fun chat to have with him. It's not our most Beatlesy chat, let's be honest, but lots of
There's a fair bit in there. We cover a lot of bases.
It was really good fun. Some great impressions coming out there. His Paul impression needs a little bit of work. It starts to sound quite North Walian, but
exactly. Yeah, it's sort of, But if you don't know Pictish Trail's stuff or Johnny's stuff, he's a brilliant sort of singer-songwriter and owns a sort of collaborative record label called Lost Map from up in the Isle of Egg, where we spoke to him from.
Yeah, and also runs a festival on Egg as well, which I really want to go to. We should try and get to that.
Yeah, it does sound amazing. I mean, even seeing like a setup in his little sort of cabin there, and he was telling us, I think we talk about it in the podcast, but just how remote it is out there in the Outer Hebrides. So we talk a lot about sort of that scene, his formative influences and his, getting to know the Beatles, having moved to America and exploring sort of secondhand CD shops, which is really interesting.
Yeah, it was good. And it was just really nice to, because I guess it's, again, similar age thing, but it's just nice to talk about that kind of interest in folk and that DIY scene around the turn of the century, which is kind of how he got interested in music. So that was kind of, I thought that was really interesting.
Lots of chat about burning CDRs.
Yeah.
I forgot just how exciting that was.
It was, yeah, amazing.
but yeah, it's been an exciting week in Beatleland as well, because we've seen the long-awaited special editions / remixed Giles Martin versions of Let It Be, which is really, for my part at least, exceeded expectations. I'm sure I've sort of pontificated about how much of a massive fan I am of that project for the 50th anniversary ones. And this was the one that I was a little bit sceptical of, because I just thought, it's not recorded at Abbey Road. A lot of those live recordings, I can't really see how much you can do with them. And that kind of is the case. You can't approve on those massively, but the stuff, recorded in Savile Row is absolutely spectacular.
Yeah.
Like, they're game-changing remixes. I think they bring out so much character, and as always, the drums just sound amazing.
Yeah.
But this one's probably, I was more excited by the kind of sundries, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's just such a brilliant edition of songs. The super deluxe edition, by the way, if you don't know what we're talking about, but which also includes the Glyn Johns mix of Get Back, which has been obviously bootlegged for a while, but now it's officially been released, as well as like numerous outtakes, including working on songs that would end up being on Abbey Road, and it's the whole thing. I should say before as well, if you want to find out more, there's two brilliant podcasts which came out this week. One of which is the Soda Jerker podcast on songwriting, where they talk to Giles Martin, which is really good. And then our chum, Joe Wisby, on Beatles Books, talking to John Harris, who did all the transcripts for the Get Back book from the Beatles conversation. That's really worth a listen to. The John Harris chat is particularly interesting because, this whole thing about Get Back, Let It Be, there's this hodgepodge idea of things that was happening where they didn't really know that they were recording an album. So it's all that kind of, are we rehearsing or are we recording an album? And so I think the thing with Let It Be it was quite a late discovery for me. I think in the first episode of this, I said, Let It Be is the one album we never had at home. I kind of, my journey with it started with this podcast, really. And the thing with the album, and then hearing, obviously, Let It Be Naked, and then the various things you can find on YouTube and bootlegs or whatever. And then, of course, the film, which is quite hard to see now. is that with the album, you kind of, at the time, or when you first hear Let It Be the album, it's a part of a whole, but you don't realize it's a part of a whole. So yeah. You make kind of all these kind of assumptions about it, and kind of there's all these kind of received, you know, interpretations and wisdom about it. You know, for instance, I remember saying, you know, the Let It Be original album contains little snippets of chatter introducing songs. And I felt at the time like, is that like they're trying to recapture something of the White Album, where there are those skits coming and going and everything? Mm. And obviously that was something that Phil Spector did like much later than the event.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, obviously my first experience when I was a kid hearing the Blue Album and wondering why Long and Winding Road, why did they do that? You know, why does it sound not like a Beatles album? And then, of course, realising that the Spector strings are not something they were happy with, and or Paul at least wasn't happy with. And so I think the amazing thing about the Super Deluxe is we get to see the whole. You know, we get to see how it all makes sense in terms of the development of it and what happened in such a short space of time. It's 3 weeks. You know, incredible.
It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And there's so much more stuff. I mean, I just loved a lot of the stuff of them just kind of jamming and the stuff that's pretty inconsequential. But yeah, a lot of those snippets, you hear them in context for the first time in any sort of official release, which is really interesting.
Yeah.
Billy Preston gets amazing. A bit more sort of centre stage in some of them. There's one particular song that he sings, which is absolutely unbelievable.
His voice is amazing.
Yeah, he's like
so good.
Properly. But though, I just love the way that they slot in backing him up and stuff as well. Yeah. I mean, I would give a lot for a Billy Preston album with a Beatles backing band.
Yeah.
If it's anything to go by.
Yeah, and Ringo as well. You mentioned the drums on Giles Martin's remixes, but Ringo's just so sensitive. The way he plays in the stuff where they're developing songs. You can tell by the way he's playing that he knows the song already, you know?
Yeah.
And he's so sensitive and integral to that. And there's the wonderful bit, obviously, which Rob Sheffield, I think, ends Dreaming the Beatles book with by pointing out that bit, you know, before Don't Let Me Down, Ringo says, John says to Ringo, I need a big crash to give me the courage to come screaming in. It's just brilliant.
It's so great.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really, a lot of those sessions are kind of, you know, act a bit like a trailer for, you know, what we might be seeing in the film and stuff. Because I assume there's footage of the majority of this stuff. So to see the fully restored versions. We also got a new trailer for that as well.
Yes.
This week, which is amazing.
I mean, I like the way they've kind of added that element of peril in, you know, like a plot kind of, it's become a thriller.
I mean, that's a little bit, the sort of lower third of the Beatles have 3 weeks to make an album or whatever.
I like that.
It's kind of, you know, you've got to sell a film like that. So we'll see how much there is of that in the actual thing.
Yeah, sure.
But, because especially compared to, because there's a lot of bits that, you know, there's a bit more sort of meat on the bones in terms of what we see from performances in this one. And so if you're someone like me who's been sort of searching around for really scratchy, horribly compressed YouTube versions of them, it is pretty amazing to see them sort of all cleaned up and stuff.
Yeah.
Although I do think, I mean, as I said to you, my immediate reaction to watching it was, I think I was probably sitting a little bit too close to the big screen to try and suck up all the detail, but there is some slightly strange sort of AI artifacts going on.
Do you reckon?
Yeah, it looks like it's sort of been cleaned up with like machine learning.
Right.
So if you look too closely, you can just see how people in the background are sort of blurred out a bit and the movement's a bit strange. And it looks like they've been kind of deep faked.
That's interesting.
I think it's the same technology that sort of recreates lost data like that.
Right. There's an interesting bit again in Giles Martin on Soda Jerk where he's talking about how he's obviously working on the music for the Get Back films. And one thing that happened was with the video, with the cameras, was that when they'd lose battery or power, the film slowed down. So they had to kind of re-speed it up and then like re-sync the music with it. And there was all kind of issues like that, which is kind of really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it must have been an absolute nightmare for 6 hours of online footage for that. But, you know, I just couldn't be more excited about listening to, especially sort of the more joyous elements of the room made me quite emotional, actually.
Oh, me too.
Totally. It made me think I'm going to be an absolute fucking wreck by the end of the 6 hours.
I mean, there is that. And obviously, I mean, this has kind of probably been gone on about a lot, but the main thing is obviously that kind of received wisdom that it was a bad time during that period. And obviously by hearing the Super Deluxe and what we'll see with Get Back is that it's not quite simple as that, you know. And there was still, you know, churning out music and getting along, but also not getting along. But, you know, it was just more ambiguous than the kind of...
I think hopefully we'll get to see a little bit more of the sort of George walkout, but hopefully also how it gets all patched up. And just feels like we're going to get a slightly... I mean, you always have to be a bit wary with these officially sanctioned projects that they might be a little bit, you know, sanitized version of history or whatever. But it does look like this is going to be quite comprehensive and no-holes barred.
Yeah. I mean,
Paul's introduction in the book is... incredibly diplomatic.
Oh, is it? Yeah. I'd like to read that. Is that
I like the line in the George Martin, when they asked George Martin how he wanted to be credited on the album, and he said, how about produced by George Martin, overproduced by Phil Spector? Which is great. But you know, we could talk about that for hours.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the other thing I wanted to point out again is obviously like Glyn Johns. It was the Glyn Johns Get Back, you know, which is part of the Super Deluxe, which I found probably the most emotional. And again, obviously, it's been around for ages and bootlegged, etc. But the, you know, the interesting thing is there's a Glyn Johns interview in Mojo where he said, you know, they all hated it when I first did it. But there's that great Paul McCartney interview, the one he did in the 80s for Q, which we mentioned with Joe Wisby, where he talks about loving it because it was quite avant-garde.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is Paul being an unreliable narrator again, probably. But,
But
I sort of had that in mind when I listened to Glyn Johns' Get Back, because it is like, it reminded me, not sonically, but it reminded me of Trout Mask Replica, in that you're constantly seeing out of the frame. You know, on Trout Mask, you can hear Zappa engineering it. You can hear them doing other takes or rehearsals of songs. You can hear them walking around outside the studio. You know, this composition is called Neon Meat Dreams of an Octopus. Oh no, it's Hair Pie. You know, you can hear all those kind of little bits.
That's a good impression.
Yeah. And like kind of running jokes. And, you know, you're constantly, the album itself is kind of about the recording process. And with the Get Back, it's the same thing. You know, we're getting to see an insight into the actual recording process, and it's rough and ready, and it's a document of that kind of time and how those songs came to be, and they're playing in kind of a really rough bluesy way. Like Harrison's guitar sounds so amazing.
Yeah, it's that Johns beautiful ones. Rosewood telly that is completely inimitable. I've never heard a telly that sounds like
it. It's great.
Probably because it weighs an absolute ton, which probably helps, but it's got some lovely tone.
My friend had the kind of Fender did...
The
did
custom
a,
shop.
Did a run of those, yeah. They're very, very, very nice. But I just think it sounds beautiful. It's really, really
But that's,
great.
You know, what you've just said, it's like that was the original intention. It just happened that it took half a century for it to sort of be realised and stuff. Yeah. And all that stuff of seeing George... again, stuff that's been around, but George writing something and John trying to, he's like, just say, you know, attracts me like a cauliflower until the right bird comes.
Yeah.
So, so great and sweet as well. And Ringo obviously writing Octopus's Garden.
I mean, and the amazing, and the amazing thing in the Get Back film is, you know, there will be a bit of Paul coming up with the song Get Back. Like, it's actually filmed him coming up with he starts playing the bass and starts singing it. You know, that's going to be quite amazing. I think tears will flow for you there, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, very, 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 very lightly, I'd say. I like the shots of him. There's some shots in the trailer of Paul playing upside down, playing George's telly as well.
Oh, really?
It'd be interesting to see how that sounded.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, we could dedicate a whole podcast to just Let It Be stuff, and maybe we will. But as I mentioned, for now, this is our last sort of regular stuff, but it won't be the last you hear of us in 2021. Nearly got the year wrong.
But
if you want to get in touch with us with, if you had an emotional reaction to any of this stuff, then, please do write in to us. You can go to personalbeatles.com/contact or email me, jack@homespunsounds.com, or get in touch in the old social medias.
Yeah. I mean, we should say, we're going to do a couple next month, I think, is the plan, and then hopefully a Christmas spesh.
In some form or other. And we got one more bonus episode coming out with Johnny White from Really Really from last series, where we're going to have a stab at covering some Beatles songs, which is going to be really fun. If you want to get that and extended versions, not expensive versions, if you want to get that and extended ad-free versions of all our episodes, you can join our Patreon. And it's you just go to patreon.com/personalbeatles. And, you know, we will be sort of winding things up now. So do feel free to join it for a month and download all the stuff you want and then leave. And we don't want people sort of playing a monthly thing after we finish. So we're probably going to shut it down. So don't worry, you won't get stung. But thanks so much for everyone who is a Patreon and for the new people that have joined and the new people that have given us nice reviews and all of that stuff. Mm. If you want to do similarly, you can, and you listen on Apple Podcasts, you can go and leave us a 5-star review there. It's very nice and it helps other people find the show and stuff. So we won't take up any more of your time in this slightly long intro.
It's a good time to be a Beatles fan, though, so, and maybe a bad time to end a Beatles podcast.
Absolute sort of content planning nightmare. But enjoy this fabulous episode with the brilliant Pictures Trail.
How was your birthday, Sesh?
My birthday? It was really great, yeah. Well, it was great. I turned 40. So it's as great as turning 40 can ever be, with all the sort of existential preamble and postamble, as it turns out, that there is. It was amazing. It was really cool. I tried to cram in as much stuff as I could over in the course of the weekend because, you know, on Egg, there's only one ferry that ever comes over per day, if you're lucky.
Yeah.
And there's no bridge to get over here, so, and weather tends to affect the ferries crossing and all that sort of stuff. And the weather was looking really dicey in the week leading up to it, and I'd invited about 30 pals to come over. And so it looked at one point like no one was going to come over, and it would just be me celebrating my birthday on my own with my kids. And, but no, it turned out amazing. Everything came together. I manufactured it so that I insisted that as soon as everyone got off the boat, they had to do a music video with me. It's my birthday. I'll do a music video if I want to. And we did. And then there was a lot of booze involved. And
that's great.
That's all I remember.
You didn't grow up on the Hebrides, did you?
No, I moved here about 11 years ago. Before that, I was living in Fife. I used to run a record label there called Fence Records.
Oh, of course, yeah.
And the Fence Collective thing there in Fife. And then I moved to Egg, and then all of that, all the Fence thing crumbled. And so I started Lost Map from here.
Yeah, amazing. I've been over to Tyree once, which is really good fun.
I've never been. This is the thing. A lot of people who say, oh, have you ever been to Egg? Oh, I've never been. I've been to these other islands.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it's all other islands I've not been to.
No. I suppose, is it a bit like when Americans say, oh, Bristol, is that near London? Or something like that. Is it a bit like that?
Well, we do get a lot of Americans here.
Yeah, okay.
Trying to uncover, like, my great-great-grandfather was from Eeg. Really? Yeah.
I mean, you say that. I did have to Google the pronunciation of it earlier. Anyway, have we started, or should we do a little intro?
Well, I quite like that. We can keep it in if we want.
Good. But welcome to your own personal Beatles, Mr. Johnny Lynch, aka Pictish Trail.
Hello.
Coming from us live from Egg, the Isle of Egg. Is it inner Hebs or outer Hebs? Wait.
In Hebs. My inner Hebs.
Lovely.
Yeah. It's part of the Small Isles.
Okay.
Which is just south of the Isle of Skye.
Is there an inner-outer rivalry? like Hebs and Hearts or something?
Or belly buttons. there isn't. This is the thing. Yeah, we tend not to fraternise with the...
Right,
with the Outer Hebrides,
the
outer that
much scumbags.
I visited. Jan Tiersen lives on the island of Wesson, off the coast of Brest. It's a really beautiful island.
I've never been.
It's fantastic, and there is another smaller island just off it, and there is a rivalry between them. The smaller island is called Île Molène, and there's a joke on Wesson, which is why do all the kids on Molène have big ears? And the answer is, it's because the parents of the kids hold them up by their ears to show them how beautiful Wesson is. So there we go. Lovely stories.
I've never been there. It's meant to be quite religious.
I think it's formerly, but not so much anymore.
I think, well, certain islands out in the Outer Hebrides still observe, a Sunday.
Right, okay.
Whereas here, we don't observe a Sunday, mostly because I think we'd sort of drink through it. You drink on the Saturday and you wake up and it's Monday. Yeah, like, oh, what?
The island scene does seem to be quite a lot of, there's quite a lot of boozing going on. Why is that? I wonder.
I have been told off by a few islanders in the past for like talking about eggs, relationship with booze. Like, oh, you're not presenting a very good picture of the island.
Yeah.
I'm presenting a very real picture. He said in quite an English voice for some reason. Yeah. I'm presenting a very real version of the island.
That's great. Oh, good. Right, sorry. Maybe we should probably talk about the Beatles, really. But,
I love the Beatles. Yeah,
we'll get there.
We'll get there in the end.
Yeah. I have to say, I love your podcast so much.
Oh, great. Thanks.
It's very kind.
And it has, in fact, sort of, it has contributed to my love of said Beatles. Because I have always been like, as you'll discover in this episode, I'm a fan of the Beatles, but I'm by no means an expert whatsoever. Mm. And so it's been really nice to be able to listen to this podcast and not feel intimidated by other people's knowledge of the Beatles. Because it is quite a, as you say in the title, it's quite a personal journey.
Yeah.
Well, that makes three of us. Welcome to Amateur Hour.
Yeah.
Although the last couple of episodes have had like some total Beatles boffins.
Yeah.
Mm.
Thanks for that.
It's good to mix it up with people who actually know what they're talking about.
So has it been, along with the podcast, has the Beatles kind of affected your listening habits in the pandemic as well, do you think? Have you found yourself listening to more?
Quite a lot recently because of this podcast.
Mm.
But so I was listening to a lot just when the series started. My friend James Hankins.
Hello, James Hankins.
Informed me that you were making it, and it sort of revived my interest in, like, oh, yeah, I should listen to the Beatles more. And we've got, me and my partner, we've got two young kids. Arlo's just turned 6, and nice. My daughter Ness, who's 2. And over the past, year and a half, it's just been sort of introducing them to music that we love, and because we've been here more. Normally in my life, I tour quite a bit, so I'm never on the island for more than a couple of weeks at a time before I have to kind of go off and tour or do meetings or whatever.
Mm.
And but this is like, this past year and a half has been really nice because it's, you know, just been, with the kids the entire time and listening to our favourite music full blast and, cool. Seeing the joy in their hearts as they discover the work of the Beatles.
Where have you been starting with them? What's it kind of?
Well, the classic kids tunes. So Yellow Submarine. And, you know, Sarah introduced Arlo to Yellow Submarine before I had any say on it. And he started singing it. And then I started listening to it. Oh my God, it's amazing.
Yeah.
It's much maligned, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And I think, I think my relationship with it's changed since we did the podcast. I'd never skip it on Revolver. But when you actually listen to it on its own sake, the world it builds is amazing with the sound effects and the production.
Beautiful.
And how catchy it is.
Oh, it's really lovely. And it's like got such a clean sound to it when the acoustic guitars come in. And there's just, it's a really a beautiful blend of instruments that kind of going on in that. Octopus's Garden, not quite as. We've managed to keep the kids away from that one.
Really? Yeah.
This is my relationship with a lot of Beatles songs now, because there's some that I'm just like, oh, I absolutely love that song with all my heart, and it'll make me feel quite emotional thinking about it or talking about it. And then there's other songs that I'm just like, oh, that's absolutely shite.
Can we start with some of the shite ones and move on to the good?
Do you want me to start with the shite ones? I don't know if this is going into the controversial Beatles opinion too early.
Well, let's see. Well, yeah, like, I mean, I think it's interesting. There's certain songs for me, for sure. Like, I've never, ever liked Can't Buy Me Love. I always thought it was just so kind of, I don't know, just sort of throwaway. I mean, it's just an opinion.
Well, it's weird because listening to this podcast has made me analyze a lot of the Beatles' works more than I had done before. But like, I think with a lot of the early stuff, because the sort of makeup of it is, the bass, drums, guitar, two guitars, and vocals. It's got that sort of that formula to it. There's just kind of, it's just fueled by amphetamines and goodwill, isn't it? The whole thing. And so, like, all that early stuff, I just kind of, I love it, but I love it all as sort of one tune.
Right, I know what you mean. Yeah, for sure.
King Creosote, who I used to do the collective with, he used to do a thing called One Chord Beatles, where he would just play all the hits of the Beatles with one chord.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And do like a never-ending medley of Beatles tunes. That was one.
Wow.
One Chord Beatles. It was fucking hellish.
Yeah.
Yeah, sounds dreadful. Yeah.
He really crowbar. Yeah, it was crap.
With the early stuff, on a casual listen, it's kind of easier to see them as more of a sort of historical document as a time, whereas the later, you know, post 65, it feels so much more timeless. It's like, but like, I do kind of go back to a lot of early stuff and really, really enjoy it now. But for, I think as for when you're first kind of getting into them, it feels like, yeah, you do kind of put them all together in one box somehow.
It's less experimentation as well, isn't it? It's just on from their, as a band, they're experimenting less in the studio at that point, and so there's less expression from that standpoint. Yeah. And so the later stuff has all that, and you're like, oh, wow, there's a whole different level, whole different world being opened up.
Yeah, for sure. That.
Although I think, because since I've read the Mark Lewisohn book, which I always bang on about in recent episodes.
It's the infinite jest of Beatles books.
Yeah, exactly. It really has opened up my love for that period. I was pretty indifferent about all of that early stuff. And although the songwriting takes a while to get interesting, the band, you know, oh my God, they're good. Like, they're just Lennon and McCartney together, and the way that their voices work in those first couple of albums is just so, there's something so magical about it that as soon as John started to sort of disguise his voice a bit with you know, artificial sort of studio stuff, he kind of lost that a bit. But so the rawness of it, I still that amphetamine-y energy is still the most exciting stuff on the record.
But I think you can sort of start to see the experimentation come in like Hard Day's Night. If you're listening kind of closely, like the songs are just going slightly more wayward. You know, Hard Day's Night itself has got
it's Macca eating some celery. Just
But like Hard Day's Night's got the kind of sped up guitar solo thing, and you know, the opening chord. There are the clues are there. They're a bit kind of smaller. You know what I mean? Like you can see them the way they're going. But yeah. Yeah, for sure.
So when you were a kid, did you have Beatles in your catalogue?
No, not at all. And this is why it's kind of, I'm quite enjoying playing stuff to the kids now and seeing what their reaction is to it. And like Arlo especially is just sort of fascinated by just the concept of rock and roll being a thing. I'm sort of living my childhood vicariously through him now, just like getting to sort of experience that, hearing the Beatles at that age. Because when I was a kid, we did, like, my parents listened to some really turgid shit, like
Mull of Kintyre. No,
well, do you know what? They didn't
get to that, but, I'm sure.
Oh, that, I love that tune, but
I quite like Mull of Kintyre.
That's amazing. But they listened to like Barbara Dixon,
okay,
who I feel bad calling that turgid shit. She's
she lives on egg.
She lives in Fife, funnily enough, or did. That sort of MOR 70s stuff. They were kind of into a little bit of that, and the like a lot of folk stuff, but really saccharine folk stuff in Scotland, like the Corries and the McCalmans. I don't know if any of that will be familiar to you, but it's not the sort of. My mum and dad were both folkies, actually, both musicians.
Right. Yeah.
And up to a certain point, and then they had children, and that all went out the window. And they had like Pentangle and you know, Bert Jansch records. And
so they had all the good stuff.
They had some good stuff, but the stuff they really loved was the turgid shit. It was the chords. and the Corrs. They didn't have the Corrys and McCalmans. Yeah. The Corrys wrote Scotland's national anthem, Flower of Scotland, which you might be familiar with.
Really?
Oh, Flower of Scotland, how when will we see your legs again? It's the Mull of Kintyre of its day.
Beautiful. Yeah. There is a good Beatles connection with Scotland, though, isn't there?
You of us wearing raincoats, standing solo in the sun, the moon. You and me chasing paper, getting nowhere on our way.
I mean, obviously Paul, but John went on chartered holidays to the Highlands famously crashed his car in like...
Durness, is that right?
I think so, yeah, with Yoko in it. And he said something like, if you're ever going to crash your car, make sure it's in Scotland or something, because he was so well looked after in the hospital.
Well, there's a place, I think it's Durness, and I could be wrong, but it's Durness. It's right at the very north top of Scotland and the other side of where John O'Groats is.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got an art centre up there, which is like about 15 years ago we played it. Mm. And I think it's called the John Lennon Art Centre.
Oh, right.
It doesn't double as an airport. And, but yeah, we did a gig there with John Cooper Clark.
Oh, amazing.
It was really nice. It was very nice.
I only really know that because that story, because Ian Rankin's last book, I read it, and it kind of covers that John Lennon story because he sets it kind of somewhere up there.
It was his excuse for having nothing to do with Maxwell Silverhammer.
Yeah. He was in a hospital.
I think he said he was, yeah. It was after the crash, I came back, they'd spend a week doing it. I was like, what the hell is this? Probably careered into a tree on purpose. whereabouts is Paul's farm then that he escaped to in sort of late Beatles, early? Where's all the ram? Is that in Kintyre? Was it in?
I think so. And it's like, that's on the west coast of Scotland. It's not the Isle of, so it's different from the Isle of Mull.
Right.
Which is an island. But Mull of Kintyre is on a peninsula on the I'm going to get my Scottish geography wrong, which is appalling, because I'm from the East Coast originally, and I only moved to the West Coast 11 years ago. Only 11 years ago.
Yeah.
And but yeah, it's on the mainland, and it's still owned by Macca, right? He's still got the land there. And
yeah, I think so. Very, I was speaking
still goes there a bit often.
Scottish friend of mine the other day, he told me the rather disappointing fact that the Long and Winding Road is literally about a long and winding road. it's not a metaphor for life, as we...
It's better than one of the stories I've heard, which is it's about Paul's willy. But, come on, let's move on.
That sounds like a Billy Connolly joke right there. Yeah. It's about Paul's willy.
Will I? Yeah.
Funnily enough, you're talking about like earliest like Beatles songs and memories and stuff. The Long and Winding Road and Let It Be were both in my, like, I was brought up Catholic, and they were both in the church hymn book, because there was a sort of, Catholic churches went a bit folky, I guess, in the 60s, 70s and 80s. And, I remember being at my uncle Chris's wedding and singing The Long and Winding Road along with everyone else in the congregation, not really knowing it at all, and suddenly singing it in church, and then it'd be, this is by the Beatles. All right. Oh. It's quite weird that contemporary pop songs would be included in Catholic Mass.
So did you have a kind of rebellion period when you were growing up, when you sort of, what was the kind of music you discovered, what that got you into music and being a musician yourself? Or?
Well, weirdly enough, I think a lot of the stuff that I liked when I first started liking music was stuff that I thought was funny.
Right.
And a bit,
because you were a comedian first, weren't you?
Did do some stand-up comedy, at university. Yeah, with pals, and was absolutely fascinated. I'm still fascinated by comedy. And I think there's something about the first love of music I had was just stuff that I thought just sounded hilarious. Mm. And I still kind of have a nostalgia for like the stuff that sounds stupid.
Yeah.
So like, I mean, not that it's stupid, but Vic Reeves stuff,
yeah.
all his
yeah.
music mm. and all the songs that Vic and Bob did on their show.
Yeah. I was absolutely
dizzy. But even the songs that they wrote in The Smell Of and the songs yeah. they did yeah. on Big Night Out and stuff, I was yeah. just thought were amazing. And
Chris
great,
Morris,
amazing
too.
Songs.
Those songs were actually really good. Like the Pixies one and the Nirvana one and
oh, yeah.
the Ice-T one.
Like Ice-T one.
Yeah, it's possibly a bit dubious now, but for Q, it was...
For Q!
Yeah, it was so funny. But have you heard the Pixies one? Because it's like, it could be a Pixies song, basically.
Do you know, I've not listened. That's from the Day to Day, is it?
It was from the radio show he did. Like I think it was the Radio 1 show he did. Or it might have been one of the local shows before that.
I've not heard it in so long. I was absolutely obsessed with all that, though, when it was first out.
But I know what you mean. Like, as a teenager, you're sort of, that all gets blurred into one a bit, doesn't it? Like, you like funny stuff and you like music and you like funny music, you know?
I mean, I loved, like, Cotton Eye Joe when that came out. I thought that was absolutely hilarious.
Yeah.
And there's something, like, there's a frequency that it used to trigger in my brain that
yeah.
I would take great pleasure listening to it. Like, right. There was a horrible moment in sort of rave culture when yeah. it sort of crossed over into chartdom
yeah.
and
yeah,
all of a sudden you had rave versions of the theme tune of Tetris and
yeah,
Super
yeah.
Mario Brothers.
Casualty.
Yeah. yeah.
yeah. The Rainbow theme tune had like there was a rave version
oh,
of
yeah,
Rainbow
yeah,
as
that
well.
Was kind of sort of almost the happy hardcore kind of stuff. It was a UK garage version of Casualty. It's actually banging.
yeah. Ironically.
Yeah. We'll put a clip of that in. So what kind of, so you listened to it, so it was Vic and Bob and other things like that, and
a lot of that stuff, and then got quite heavily into Oasis.
Yeah.
yeah, and so it's funny actually hearing I Am the Walrus for the first time. My first exposure to I Am the Walrus was the Oasis's cover version.
Yeah. It doesn't matter if it's out of tune, that one. Yeah.
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 It is great, that cover version.
Yeah, I think
I'll stick up for that.
Yeah.
Oh,
just
yeah.
have that on the main road VHS in 1996.
Yeah, I'm still quite passionate about all that stuff in a weird way. Like, it's sort of, it's very nostalgic to me, like all the sort of Oasis stuff, bizarrely. Mm. It's so nice that you had Christian Madden on the show last year, because the Earlys produced my first album.
Right, yeah.
As Pictish cool. Trail. And so it's so insane to see Christian now in Liam's band.
I know.
And like performing. I was watching footage of like Liam performing at the Transmit Festival in Glasgow the other week. And it's all these 20-year-olds singing... like Oasis B-sides and stuff. And you're like, what?
I just love how Christian... when I always try to like pause the TV when he's on. Screenshot or something. But like
behind
Christian always looks...
rock and roll
yeah.
keyboard.
Christian always looks like slightly bored when he's playing. He's so funny. He's one of the funniest people I've ever met, Christian.
Turning into quite a brilliant gig, that, because,
yeah.
you know, for the nice, with the nicest will in the world, a solo Liam Gallagher record 4 years ago... You didn't think you were going to be playing fucking Nebworth.
Yeah, yeah.
I know. It's unbelievable.
It's good.
I suppose it's the 90s. Do you think that's a part of the sort of 90s revival that seems to be happening?
Well, it seemed like... it's weird, isn't it, that that's happening now? Because I remember in the sort of late 90s, early noughties, just this constant 80s revival that never seemed to fucking go away. And maybe it's still going on. But as we're all getting older and... wow, people didn't die as quickly as we thought they would.
Maybe it's so there's something about the 30-year rule then, because we talk a lot about the Beatles renaissance in the 90s.
Yeah.
Maybe there's something about that magic.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Time period that makes you slightly, when you're just about old enough to start getting nostalgic for your for your teenage years.
It's interesting. I think it's all about handling your legacy, and I think Liam, I mean, this is true of the Beatles, obviously, because I don't think anyone's handled the legacy better than them. Like when, especially when you think like Queen put an advert for on like, you know, B&Q or something to use, you know, or whatever it was, you know. But like
Skechers.
Yeah. But like Liam Gallagher, I think, has handled his legacy quite well, apart from BDI.
Can I just that second BDI album stands up. I'm gonna put that really? Out there. But anyway. you just mentioned Queen then. It reminded me of the most offensive thing that I've heard on this show, which was is it John
Robbins.
Robbins. Yeah. Saying that, yeah. I remember feeling physically sick when he said that the Beatles were uncool and that Queen were a cooler band than the Beatles.
Oh, no, wasn't it that Queen was... The Beatles weren't
they
sexy.
They weren't sexy.
That was his... What he kept
Queen was sexier than... The, I mean, yeah. I've never thought of Roger Deakins as an incredibly sexy man.
Wait. John Deacon or Roger Taylor.
Who's Roger Deakins? Oh, the cinematographer. Well, he is a sexy man. Very good with the camera.
Actually, now that you've said the word sexy, I'm feeling that vomit again. Just that picture of Brian May with his big hairy back comes into... Have you seen that photograph of Brian May leering over the precipice somewhere and he's got a big hairy back?
Oh, he's got like a Ryan Giggs torso, has he?
Oh, wow.
He's got... No, it's disappointing. It's just the top of his shoulders. He's got grey curly hair that sort of like melts into his sort of hairy shoulders. I always think of... Jimmy Carr's joke on the Big Fat Quiz of the Year, where he goes, they go through all the months of the year, and he says, like Anita Dobson, we reluctantly slide on to May.
I was thinking Brian May, since he's gone grey stroke white, his hair look. Whenever you see a photo of him, his hair looks like it's been rubbed out, you know, with an eraser. There's just a big white patch above his head.
You know. Been airbrushed.
Yeah.
I've had the uncoolest, unsexiest music history of all time. I listened to the Beatles in church, and then I was heavily into Rednecks, and then I got into the Oasis. And just look at me now. I was thinking about my earliest Beatles memory, actually, though, the other day, and I think I mentioned it to you in an email before, and it was French and Saunders doing their cover of Help for
Help,
Comic Relief.
Yeah. With Bananarama.
Bananarama.
Yeah.
And I remember absolutely loving that, listening to that when Derek Jameson would play it on the radio on Radio 2 in the mornings, driving to school.
Yeah. Classic. I mean, it was better than the Stonk, you know, so...
That was really quite bad, wasn't it? Yeah. Although what we wouldn't give now for a song of that calibre.
The quality of the Stonk. Yeah, God.
I don't remember the Stonk.
You don't remember the Stonk?
To the rhythm of the honky-tonk, put a red nose on your conk and let's stonk.
Who was responsible for that lovely ditty?
Hail and Pace.
Hail and Pace.
Hail and Pace. Yeah.
The single also featured Brian May, Tony Iommi and David Gilmour.
They're only the band that French and Saunders could have been.
So have you got much Beatles in your own music then? Is it a sort of conscious influence?
Yeah, and it kind of came quite... it definitely is. And it's something really struck me about the Beatles that when I was a teenager, I was in... we moved from the UK to America. So I did high school in the States. And up until that point, I'd never really heard any Beatles properly because I'd only heard like French and Saunders version. Yeah. And I would only have heard like the Oasis version of I'm the Walrus.
Yeah.
And then, and just, you know, occasionally seeing Macca on Saturday morning television doing a phone in or something like that. So my sort of relationship with the Beatles was kind of like, just didn't really know any of the songs, really. And then went to America and they've got classic rock radio there, which on the school bus, they, you know, you'd be hearing all this sort of classic, you know, the British Invasion, all this, all these bands from the 60s that just didn't get played on the radio in the UK as much when I was growing up, or it certainly didn't feel like it. Like, I think BBC Radio and all that sort of stuff just only would ever play the hits of the day and would kind of shy away from playing anything from the 60s or whatever because it sounded dated. But in the States, they absolutely love it, and it's on all of the time. Yeah. And so I remember hearing that stuff and just being like, oh, wow, this is what the Beatles sound like. And then buying, like, we could never afford to buy the CD's back catalogue, the Beatles, we could never afford to buy the Beatles back catalogue on CD because it was just so riotously expensive always. But in the States, they've got so many secondhand CD stores. I used to spend my entire teenage years were just spent in the two or three different secondhand CD stores, just kind of going through the racks and buying, like, I remember buying the Blue album, the best of 67 to 70, and putting it on and listening to Strawberry Fields, and it just totally blowing my mind. Just, I don't think anything's been, I've never listened to music in the same way since. It just, it was so unexpected. It was so unexpected what it was. I just, because my impression of the Beatles at that point had been just the mop top, you know, lads on Ed Sullivan show and all the sort of early hits that were kind of, you know, yeah, background music almost in my life at that point. But yeah, hearing that and just hearing what music could be and it just being so completely different to everything that was contemporary at that point as well. Just like, everything contemporary that I'd been listening to, I was just, I'm emotional now even thinking about it. It just totally caught me off guard. And just being able to, like, the lyrics of that tune, like listening to a song where you could have those lyrics that just are completely nonsensical and just so experiential, just like, whoa, this is allowed. Hold on. What? How is this even possible? It's amazing.
Yeah, it is. I mean, yeah, I always think that, like, the way he includes the kind of, yes, I mean, you know, and that kind of halting delivery, it takes you into something that's so personal, unique to him, I think, that, you know.
And then when you later discover the world of drugs...
And then
it becomes even more amazing that he's able to sort of articulate that mad feeling of being outside yourself or having this incredible self-awareness but not being able to articulate it in you know, coherent sentences. Just beautiful.
It's extraordinary how that the message of that song, which is essentially I can't describe the way I'm feeling. message is communicated so fluently because everyone has that reaction to the song. They're just like, it seems to sum up a feeling for them, you know. There's what is it? It's impossible to define what is it about that song that it's just mesmeric to so many people.
You know? It's insane, isn't it? Mm. It's just so, like, yeah, just completely, it blows. Just blows my mind. It blew my tiny mind. I think I mean a no, a yes, but it's all right. That when I think, that is, I think it's not too bad. What? But just hearing that that was allowed.
Yeah.
And had been held in with such reverence, you know, like that. Oh yeah, the Beatles, Strawberry Fields. Oh, what an amazing song! And then hearing all about how amazing the Beatles were, and, you know, and the greatest band of all time. But then having such a personal experience with it, and listening to it, and going, "Oh wow, no, this is totally amazing."
Do you remember when? This is going to take us back to Earth. But do you remember, like, Deep Blue Something when they had their hits with Breakfast at
Tiffany's. I just remember everyone was like, what is that song about?
But I just remember hearing that and being like, oh, they're trying to do a thing of like have conversational. I think I remember the film, and as I recall, you know,
we both kind of liked it.
Yeah. And I just remember thinking, how is that so bad? But when John Lennon does it, it's like completely transcendental. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
I think you have to have a bit of cultural cachet before you would come in with
possibly,
that.
Possibly, yeah.
I think when you go to the British Library and you see the lyrics on the wall, I'm talking about Strawberry Fields here, not Breakfast at Tiffany's. Yeah. But it does look like it's scrawled by an absolute maniac.
Really?
Yeah, because it's all in blue and red pen. It's completely indecipherable, and you can just about make up. I mean, it's interesting that you can read all of those yes or no bits are in there. But it does look like someone, like, you know, if they brought that in to the studio the next day, you'd be like, go to bed, mate. What on earth have you been doing?
Deep Blue Something played in Bristol a few years ago. I saw the flyer and it said playing Breakfast at Tiffany's and their other hits. Well, they didn't
other hits?
Yeah, they didn't have any other hits. Anyway, sorry, I've got sidetracked with Deep Blue Something.
Seem to remember, and I'm just looking this up now, but yeah. I've got a feeling that they did a Beatles cover.
Really? That was often the way if you had a one-hit wonder. You'd come back with a cover.
Deep Blue Something covered Dear Prudence.
I remember seeing Chesney Hawkes in St Andrews Student Union.
And, yeah, he played the student gigs.
He played the one and only
twice.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So it wasn't even the one and only performance of the one and only. It happened again. And then he played Yellow by Coldplay. It was nice. Brilliant.
Yeah. I can't remember who did Heaven and a Half Pipe, but I saw them do that twice.
Oh, wow. I can't remember now. Bowling for Soup.
My friend said he went to see Embrace on their first tour, and they opened with All You Good, Good People, and then closed with All You Good, Good People, but because they didn't have enough songs, they did the entire set again.
Oh, my God. I remember hearing, do you know that story about Aerosmith? They always used to end their set with one song. Maybe it was Walk This Way or something. And they were so mashed one day that they went on and played it. They thought, let's play it first. And they played the song and then just walked off stage because they thought it was the end of the gig. That was good.
Good night.
Yeah. I was showing someone the other day who, we'll get this back to the Beatles, who saw Wings, one of their first ever gigs. And Wings did the same thing where they didn't have enough songs. So they played their set twice. I think it was like Nottingham Uni or
was
something.
Was that the tour when they were just doing student unions?
Yeah. Yeah,
that would have been quite fun to see.
God, you'd be so tempted to shout out Beatles requests, wouldn't you?
he must have got tons of that, right? Mm. Surely when they started touring again.
Yeah.
Mm. I mean, I'd hear Jet twice any day.
Yeah.
I've never really done a big deep dive into Wings, either of you?
There's certain tunes that, just totally... It's weird because it's got such a mad reputation, that band, hasn't it? But there's certain tunes that are just so amazing. That Let 'Em In tune is a fucking beast.
Yeah, cracking. Yeah.
So good. That's a real sort of like end of disco. You've been partying. You have that go on at like 6 a.m. in the morning. Let 'Em In. Oh, beautiful.
Do you know the song My Love? The Wings song. You'll probably know it when you hear it. The very, very funny... bit in Dreaming the Beatles about that, where Rob Sheffield, the author, just thinks it's the worst song that's ever been recorded because he's basically trying to do Something by George Harrison but failing miserably because he makes it all about himself. He just says it's like, you know, it's not about someone else, it's about what you mean to me, you know.
I just I genuinely really like that song.
Do you? Yeah.
Yeah. And because I thought it was quite a sort of deep cut when I found it, and I'd had no idea of the absolutely honking reputation that it has. But I always quite like it. I love his vocal on it. It's amazing.
Isn't that the classic thing with McCartney, is that he has these songs which like are completely written off by music journalists. I remember like constantly reading in Q magazine as a teenager and Mojo and all that, you know, people slagging off Mull of Kintyre and like, what an absolute joke of a tune that is. And when I finally actually heard that song, I was like, my God, this song is beautiful.
I think it's quite beautiful.
I absolutely love that song. I think it's amazing. Do you think anyone feels a similar way about the Paul McCartney song Freedom? Because that is a fucking pile of shit, that
song. Yeah, I mean, he doesn't play it anymore, does he? It was a bit like misjudged, wasn't it? To use the word fight for your right to live in freedom.
I mean, I will fight for the right. He even sings it in that like transatlantic American voice that he does sometimes. Oh, I love. But the thing is, what is great about that is that song gave birth to that YouTube clip of him and Eric Clapton where he's backstage and he's saying to, yeah, you know, I've just done this song and, you know, it's a simple little blues thing. It's got some G and just, I can't really do a Mac impression.
Sounded like he went to North Wales, which is not far from Liverpool,
right,
to be fair.
Right, it goes up to that. It's a G, right?
But what's great is that he's doing this whole bit in front of Clapton, who's just like, all right, yeah it's just, you know, it's an easy number. It goes from G and then into a minor thing, yeah. And you just join in, just join in. You know, it goes to A minor.
A minor.
But Clapton's it's worth it just to see the look of absolute disgust on Clapton's face. And I just think, yes, Clapton, you fuck. you're going to get fucking spoon-fed by Macca because you just know your place. You just play that little simple chord progression that Macca's fucking spoon-feeding to you. You stupid git.
Anyway, yeah, Mull of Kintyre. It's got that lovely major seventh note in it because it's a pentatonic melody, isn't it?
I mean, I have no idea.
Because it had to be pentatonic to be played on bagpipes.
Of course, yes.
There's a lovely... It's quite, the way it works over the chords is really, really lovely. It's a beautiful melody, I think.
It's one of my friends for my birthday who is one of those people that listens to this podcast but never stops going on about how he doesn't like the Beatles. sort of bought me a Pipes of Pete's as an ironic birthday present a couple of weeks ago. I don't know if we mentioned it on the podcast, but it's absolutely brilliant. So joke's on you, Jimbo.
I really like Frog Song.
Yeah, me too.
Bang into it.
It's beautiful.
I remember getting the book and the audio tape when I was a kid and listening to that and the big froggy chorus, the choir at the end. The sort of the deep bass tenor.
I was about to say I can smell another impression.
Sorry. I'm compelled.
It's great.
But it's weird, like David Bowie does the Snowman. Everyone's like, oh, that's so wicked.
Yeah, it's true, yeah.
Paul McCartney does Rupert the Bear.
I was like, what a prick.
Slagged. They're both great. What are you drinking, Johnny?
I'm drinking Williams Brothers Brewery Joker IPA.
Oh, it's nice, yeah.
Tried that.
They're based in Alloa, and they're actual brothers. The Williams brothers.
Nice.
We put on events as Lost Map occasionally on the mainland in Edinburgh and Glasgow, and when we do our own bar, we get Williams Brothers beer in, and they're very nice. They set up the bar for you.
You're going to be staggered at how I've managed to get this back to the Beatles, but Sean Lennon really likes Williams Brothers because you remember Sean Lennon did an album called Midnight Sun a few years ago when he did this kind of side project.
They've got a
beer called Midnight Sun. So when he was touring in Scotland, he was drinking Williams Brothers. So there we go.
Wow. There you go. We can bring it back from anywhere. Yeah.
The beer of the Beatles, sons. Mm.
They never really had, you know, they're not very beery, the Beatles, are they? I suppose they just used to drink like Watney's Red Barrel or something.
Lager and lime in help.
Yeah, lager and lime. Yeah, that's true. It's true.
I think they were boozed. Like, they must have boozed. It wasn't just tea. I want to tell her that I love her a lot, but
I gotta get a belly full of wine. So you mentioned earlier that in the States you spent a lot of time in those record shops where you discovered sort of secondhand Beatles albums, but was that kind of where your musical tastes developed when that period in the States?
By being in these record shops discovered, the Beatles and then really heavily into Belle and Sebastian, and
yeah.
the Beat-A-Band was really like a massive turning point for me.
Yeah.
It's funny how it takes leaving home for you to fall back in love with that stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
Did you ever get into sort of solo Beatles stuff at that point?
No, not really. Until later. I think it was only when I came back to Scotland and I went to university in St Andrews and went into the local record shop there, which was run by Kenny Anderson, King Creusot. He used to he worked in the local CD shop and buying Plastic Ono Band, hearing that and be like, oh my God. they kept going.
Yeah.
There's more.
Yeah.
Just loving all that.
I read somewhere, I think it's on your website, about how one thing you like to write about is isolation, which made me think of the Lennon song. But what did you mean by that, do you think, when you said that's one of the things you write about?
I think it's just I tend to write songs that are quite insular, I guess, or looking within oneself. just as, like, I guess that Strawberry Fields tune did. That Strawberry Fields tune, do you know the one I mean? it's just music for me has always been about trying to express that thing that's slightly unknowable.
Yeah.
And always trying to reach for that sort of self-awareness, or trying to reach for that thing of knowing, trying to figure out who you are. And
that's so interesting. And because I think, maybe it's doing Paul a disservice, but do you think John is definitely more the Beatle who's in tune with that kind of thing?
I don't know. It's hard to say, isn't it? Because he's just that. It seems with John and Paul, the whole thing seems to be always about breaking them down to their personality types and how they reveal their personalities through their songwriting, right? And that seems to be the whole debate around, you know, are you John or are you Paul or whatever? And people are constantly trying to find that understanding, aren't they? This is the thing about music, is that and podcasts such as this and talking about music, is that it's always trying to find that undefinable thing. Like it's human nature to want to break down that thing that is unknowable, I think, and trying to and music is a sort of language that we can't. This just sounds like hippie bullshit, doesn't it? It is like a language that we can't, that we're all fluent in, and yet we don't quite understand what it actually is.
Yeah.
And so trying to work out the sort of, why it is.
Yeah.
Why is music seems to be the thing. So it's, when it comes to finding the differences between John and Paul, that seems to be the eternal question. And actually there's probably enough evidence on both sides for them. I don't know.
I think definitely that. I mean, you know, if you think Strawberry Fields starts, living is easy with eyes closed, and that is a great line about, you know, the internality, I suppose, the looking inside yourself. I do think with Lennon there is that thing where he was always writing and looking within, whereas Paul's kind of more looking outwards, maybe. But maybe that's just a complete oversimplification.
No, I think you're probably right. He might argue. He might be like, actually, the frog song
was
some deep inner turmoil. That,
the frog was me. Yeah.
We are all the frog.
Yeah. The walrus was Paul. The frog was Paul.
Maybe he's just got a less direct way of saying that. I mean, we always talk about that, the fact that they're double A-sides, Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields, and they basically evoke a similar kind of feeling, but they are completely different songs. And, you know, in the sort of mundanity of the barber showing photographs, it's not quite open your mind, float downstream, or, you know, it's not trying to be as sort of directly spiritual, is it? But there's still something in there that connects with you in a similar way.
Just wanted to clarify that Jack is aware that Turn Off Your Mind, Relax and Float Downstream is from Tomorrow Never Knows, not Strawberry Fields. I think he was just using it to illustrate a kind of classic Lennon lyric there. Anyway, on we go.
I think lyrically, Macca just does is quite different to how John writes. But like his voyage of discovery is through the sort of weird... the journey that it takes you on with the melodies and with the chord changes and the key changes in his tunes that happen, John's songwriting, correct me if I'm wrong, is sort of particularly in the sort of later period of the Beatles, is more linear, is, and just kind of follows
it's more stream of consciousness, and
it doesn't veer off into any sort of wild chord progressions or anything like that.
Certainly by the time of Plastic Ono Band, I'd say it's stripping back a lot to something very, very simple and repetitive, you know.
Yeah, they're very distilled ideas, I suppose. Aren't they?
But I find it really hard to talk articulately about... I'm so glad I've come on your podcast about the Beatles, because it's that unknowable thing. It's trying to capture an understanding of what of the creative process, which is we're all interested in that. We'd all love to work out how do you come up with your ideas?
There are many ways in which the thing I am trying in vain to say can be tried in vain to be said. Bruce Forsyth said, no, that was Samuel Beckett. Said that. But that's such a great line, that you're just endlessly trying to define the thing that you don't not sure if you can define.
Well, I hope to God we don't find it, or we'll be fucked.
Oh, it was this. Yeah.
But then I don't even think it's funny, because I think even as songwriters...
Paul is better.
It's funny, even as songwriters, I think it's kind of they must have gone on that journey themselves, and it's, trying to recapture old past glories and past successes, and sometimes reaching that and sometimes getting it and then sometimes not getting it. It's weird. I was listening to one of your episodes recently where you were talking about the reissue of Flaming Pie, and I thought,
oh yeah,
that was talked about quite fondly, wasn't it, at the time when it came out, and people were like, oh, Macca's back and this is a great album. And then I listened to it this week. It's fucking shit.
Oh, no.
It's rubbish.
Calico Skies is great. I love Calico Skies.
That young boy tune.
That's great.
Rubbish.
Beautiful Night. But yeah, you do get the feeling that Paul albums are, to a certain degree, reviewed completely on like how trendy he happens to be in the current zeitgeist. Because, you know, they don't get a fair crack of the whip a lot of the time.
There's always like my friend, I've probably said this before, but like my friend Sam was saying, there's always like... And he's a huge Paul fan, and he's always saying, like, whatever you think of the album, there's always like at least one or two, like, you know, gold standard Paul songs on the album. So like Off the Ground, Golden Earth Girl on that album is fucking brilliant. It's such a good song. I love that song. But like he could still do it, like, even though he wasn't particularly cool at that point in time.
I mean, Biker Like an Icon's not brilliant.
It's all right.
never knew what that meant.
Over the course of this podcast, I've just been like, you know what, it's all good. I don't care. Everything is good.
Every single, you know, like you're saying, if we can't put our finger on it and they can't put their finger on it, like, you know, he knows that there's no lightning in the bottle technique to songwriting.
Totally. It's just about committing to it and just going, right, this is what I want to write about in this moment, and let's just see what happens.
Like Paul sometimes seen when he's interviewed, sometimes says, oh, he said the thing like, oh, I feel like writing a song now, and it's like a piece of work. Richard Thompson does like that as well. It's almost like getting up and sitting at a desk every morning. Do you ever write songs in that way, where kind of like, I'm going to write a song today, or do they come much more organically?
So nowadays, since having kids, I sort of have to compartmentalize when I do music. And actually,
I feel like it's been really good. So for me as a songwriter, I feel like I feel much more confident in the stuff that I'm producing now, because it's, and I spend specific time doing it in very concentrated bursts. So there'll be like 2 or 3 weeks where that's all I'm doing is just spending time writing songs and recording stuff, and then taking it to my friend Rob. The last few albums I've recorded with my friend Rob Jones, who is based down in Aldershot.
Nice.
Rock City. And we record in his wee studio there, and cool. Then I'll take the music back and I'll sort of let it digest and then go, then return to it, and it becomes like a sort of editing process, the sort of, and where the song writing can still kind of go off in a different direction. So it's become that now, and I'm glad it is that, because it means that when I am sitting down doing the writing, I've got a bunch of stuff that's stored up and it all comes out in one big splurge. And it's just sort of organising the splurge.
Yeah.
That's sure. How I write my songs. This is my new podcast, Organising the Splurge.
It's a good album name.
Do you find though, when you've recorded a demo and then you record it in the studio, do you ever like think, oh, actually I prefer the demo?
Well, nowadays with Rob, I take the stuff that I've recorded on my Zoom multi-track recorder and we'll take it down and we'll take those elements. So a lot of...
Okay.
I just released a single called Natural Successor.
Yeah, that's
and,
great.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, and the Django remix as well.
That just came out. So that song I recorded in a wee bothy that we've got just up from the house, and called St. Franny's Bothy. Mm. And I spent a week in there at the beginning of this year writing some new tunes and put my bass guitar through my sampler to get, had this really nice sort of gain setting on it that makes it sound really, it's just the best distortion sound that I'd heard up until that point with my own recording. And just recording that onto my 8-track with a really shitty drum machine. And then took that idea down to Rob, and he was like, well, this part is really great and this is really great. So a lot of the stuff, particularly on this forthcoming record and on Thumb World, is stuff that I am playing and recording and doing myself. And so there's not much re-recording that's having to be done. It's more just sort of playing stuff to complement it that makes it, that balances it out and makes it sound nice.
Nice.
Makes it sound listenable to the public consumption.
What's your favourite Beatles album?
Do you genuinely want to know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's still the Blue album. And it's specifically the first disc, first CD disc of the Blue album.
Cool.
Because the second disc...
Old Brown Shoe.
I like
Old Brown Shoe. But even before that, like, back in the USSR, can't be bothered with it.
Not for me.
While My Guitar Gently Weeps... Fucking shit, sorry, Clapton. Obla-di obla-da, need I say more? Then you got Get Back, okay. Don't Let Me Down, all right.
Brilliant.
Ballad of John and Yoko.
Like it.
Okay, Old Brown Shoe, shit.
No. The thing is with the Blue album that, like...
Robin didn't like that.
Sorry.
The cuts from Sgt. Pepper sound very weird outside of Sgt. Pepper, I think. Like, the song Sgt. Pepper doesn't really make sense if it's not on the album Sgt. Pepper.
See, this is maybe this is where I should reveal my controversial Beatles opinion.
Go for it.
Yeah, it's time.
Maybe I've already done it. That I think, I don't, and maybe you guys will know, you might know what the answer to this is, but like, do you know who sequenced the track listings for their studio albums? Was it the band?
Yeah, they were all quite closely involved in that.
Yeah, I think up until the end where there were big disputes over it, and then Let It Be was the one that they did without Paul knowing.
But the White Album was famously like a 24-hour session of the final mix and track listing, yeah.
I think George Martin had a big input as well.
Mm.
Because I think... their track listings are, particularly on the big albums, are so wrong.
Really?
And I think it's probably because my first experience of the Beatles was listening to The Best of the Beatles.
Best of the Beatles, yeah.
Because listening to that album, like, well, I have to get the track listing in front of me. Like
Pepper.
Well, listening to the Blue album and hearing A Day in the Life in the middle of that album.
Yeah, it's quite weird.
It makes total sense. That's exactly where it should be on Sgt. Pepper.
Right. Okay. And,
like, it shouldn't be the final song. The last song on Sgt. Pepper should be With a Little Help from My Friends. Like, that is the most...
It's an upbeat ending.
Yeah, but it's a journey, isn't it? So you've, like, you know, you start and then you've got the day in life in the middle and you're like, where the fuck am I in the middle of nowhere? And then, but everything's all right in the end because I get by with a little help from my friends. With a Little Help from My Friends is track two on Pepper, right?
Mm.
That is the most insane track listing I've ever heard in my entire life.
I tell you one thing, track listing wise, Revolver, I Want to Tell You, is followed by Got to Get You Into My Life, which I think is so unfair to George because I Want to Tell You sounds like it's about to turn into Got to Get You Into My Life.
Mm.
And so it's just like...
Yeah, they're too similar.
They're too similar. Similar feel, similar rhythm.
And I also think that about Fixing a Hole and Getting Better.
Mm.
They're too similar.
That's interesting. There's a one on Help that me and my brother always used to point out where it's tonally... One song ends, the next one begins, and the song sounds really out of tune because of the key of the previous song. Another girl.
You're gonna lose that girl.
Yes, you're gonna lose that girl.
You're gonna lose.
Yes, you're gonna lose that girl.
If you don't take her out tonight, she's gonna change.
At this point, Johnny asked us if Norwegian Wood was the second song on Rubber Soul, and of course Jack and I knew that. We didn't have to look it up or anything. Norwegian Wood is the second song, yes. Yes.
It should be the last song. It should be the last song on that album.
Oh, that's a good shout, though.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good shout. That's a great shout. Yeah.
And only because Corner Shop had it at the end of their...
Yeah, they did. Yeah, yeah, I love that, which was approved by Yoko to do that. Because obviously they changed the... It was recorded in the Punjabi language, wasn't it?
Yeah, great band. What a band.
So that was Johnny Lynch, aka Pictish Trail, and a fascinating chat it was too.
Yeah. Good egg. Very, very funny man. Good egg.
Yeah, good egg. Yeah.
Very funny man. I mean, he started off doing comedy, I believe, and just so, yeah, I love his voices. I loved his. How he couldn't stop singing. It's great. It's brilliant.
And, just brilliant enthusiasm and passion for sort of writing and recording and music in general, which is very infectious.
Yeah, check out his album Thumb World. It's very, very good.
Yeah, it's great. So thank you so much for listening. If you want to hear an extended version of that episode, you can go to our Patreon, patreon.com/personalbeatles, where you can get ad-free extra extended versions of all of our podcasts in this series, as well as your monthly bonus ones. And as mentioned at the top of the show, this is the end of our sort of regular run, but we will be back with a few more shows before the year is out, including upcoming bonus one with Johnny White, Really, Really, and some very exciting things up our sleeve that aren't yet confirmed, but hopefully will happen. Yeah. So we'll remain tight-lipped about it for now.
Schrodinger's sleeve.
Yeah, exactly. And, I was thrilled that Johnny even used our new catchphrase, which we accidentally invented a couple of weeks ago. So for you and everyone else listening, goodbye and keep beetling on.
Keep beetling on.
Your Own Personal Beatles is presented by Jack Pelling and Robin Allender. The podcast artwork is done by Morgan Ritchie. It's produced by me, Jack Pelling, and is a Homespun Sounds production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.